Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Coming up on the broadcast today, the week on Wall Street and beyond, what Washington is going to get from its lobbyists. And we go down East Main with Jim Fallows and American Futures from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday, the 25th of October. Good to have you here for the podcast today, everybody. It has been relatively calm this week, economy-wise, at least as compared to last week and the week before that. And the week before that. To summarize and explain and analyze, we've got Heidi Moore from The Guardian and Cardiff Garcia from the blog FT Alphaville in our bureau in New York City. Hey, guys.
Hey, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
So cast your mind backwards there, Cardiff, to a week or two ago, it was all shut down and debt limit and all that stuff. Have we shaken it off yet? Has the economy, and I know this is a very hyperbolic question, been able to move past all that and stabilize a bit?
Almost certainly not. And I think we got confirmation of that in the jobs numbers, right? I mean, those jobs numbers took place before the economy, right? But what they showed was that the economy was already slowing down its pace of growth from earlier in the year. And that's worrying because that happened before the shutdown. So on the one hand, the direct impact of the shutdown should be pretty modest and it should be able to reverse itself within the course of a few months. But we don't know that for sure. And it came at a really bad time. So my guess is that no, that this did have some economic harm and we're going to have to get through it.
Heidi, how much longer does this uncertainty last? Probably through January, February when these next deadlines come up.
Yeah, absolutely. Next week, the quote-unquote committee, which will accomplish nothing, is supposed to meet. And it will go through January and February because even though people say this won't happen again, it probably will. And the economy's growth is tanking. Right now, the predictions about GDP growth are 1.8%, which is really low. Zero is no growth.
Well, no, I get that. But isn't tanking a little harsh when you're talking 1.8% in a world where 2% has been considered good? I mean, tanking's a little harsh, right?
Well, I like that you just did your thriller
because
that's what it's going to be. No, it's far worse than what we should be doing. And people are unemployed. We have all the people in poverty right now, 42 million people on food stamps. We can't take these kinds of risks. And unfortunately, we did.
All right. Fair enough. Cardiff, I'm going to read you something that came over the Associated Press wire literally as the gong was sounding. And I'm just going to read it to you and then we will discuss. Washington, AP. J.P. Morgan is paying $5.1 billion to resolve U.S. claims over mortgage securities sold to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. This is yet another J.P. Morgan fine over bad deeds during the financial crisis. Why do people still think, or do people still think, that J.P. Morgan is the greatest bank ever and Jamie Dimon, the CEO, ought to run the world?
I was going to say, how do you define people?
Yeah, well,
look, this is something that's been going on for a little while now. J.P. Morgan's had a litany of regulatory and legal problems. Now, these things do go back into the past, so the situation is a little bit trickier because a lot of this stuff, I think, took place when it was Bear Stearns and Washington mm-hmm. Mutual. But mm-hmm. J.P. Morgan bought those companies. You don't get to buy just the good and shed the bad. You have to embrace the whole thing, and they bought them. So, yeah, I'm sorry, but it's getting what it deserves.
Do you, Heidi, are you surprised at all that we're still dealing with this 5 years later?
If anything, I'm gratified that we're dealing with it 5 years later because the alternative was never to deal with it. And that was the path that it looked like we were on just, a year ago. And so now you're seeing all of these settlements coming down the pike and they are long overdue. And they are not nearly, if you ask me, as punitive as they should be, considering how much was lost in the economy, how much was lost in the value of people's homes, how much was lost in job growth. So J.P. Morgan can pay $13 billion and go on its merry way. The rest of us are still struggling with financial anxiety for the most part.
All right. Very quick sidebar, and then I'll let you guys go. There was some news today that Senator Rand Paul out of Kentucky is going to put, quote, unquote, a hold on the nomination of Janet Yellen to be the chairwoman of the Fed. She starts her meetings up on Capitol Hill next week. How bad would it be, Cardiff, if he actually did this?
Look, I think it would be terrible because she's so very well qualified and because the economy at least had this one sense of certainty about what was coming next. I mean, it wasn't wholly certain, but it was very likely until we heard this that she would be confirmed. My guess is that this is still just a bunch of showboating and then we're not going to go through another whole big thing in the wake of the shutdown. But, I mean, that's my hope. I don't know that for sure. So I hope he knocks it off.
All right. Cardiff Garcia at the blog FT Alphaville and Heidi Moore at The Guardian from our studios in New York. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you.
Thanks, Kai.
All right. Have a good weekend. On Wall Street today, choppiness with an upward bias. I heard somebody on the financial TV shows say that today. We have the details when we do the numbers. Painkillers are a huge business in this country, and they're a big problem, too. Thousands of people die every year from overdosing on prescription medications that can contain an ingredient called hydrocodone. You might be more familiar with it under brand names like Vicodin and Lortab. It's the kind of thing people get after a root canal, just for instance. Anyway, the Food and Drug Administration is cracking down. It's reclassifying those medicines to make them harder for patients to get. And Marketplace's Amy Scott reports the change may put the pharmaceutical industry in need of some medication of its own.
The FDA wants to move drugs containing hydrocodone from what's called Schedule 3 to Schedule 2. That means patients have to have a written prescription, no calling it in, and there would be no refills without a doctor visit. For the $8.5 billion painkiller industry, it's a blow.
It definitely depresses the demand for that product, and the sales tend to go down.
That's consultant David Williams with the Health Business Group. He says it's not just that patients will have to go through more hoops. Schedule 2 comes with a stigma.
And now prescribers will realize that these drugs are more dangerous than they may have thought and be less likely to prescribe them just because of that.
Patient advocates and doctors groups fought hard against the change. Cindy Steinberg is with the U.S. Pain Foundation. She says for people with chronic pain,
this burden of having to now physically get themselves to a doctor and get themselves to a pharmacy is a real hardship.
Those extra visits may also cost patients more. Andrew Kolodny is president of Physicians for Responsible Opioid Prescribing. He says painkiller addiction often starts with hydrocodone. He says drugs like Vicodin were in the wrong class, and that may have led doctors to overprescribe them.
That was communicating to the medical community that they don't have to worry so much about Vicodin. And that's completely not true.
But just a day after the FDA recommended tighter restrictions on drugs containing hydrocodone, it approved an even stronger one. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Fans of the photo sharing app Instagram will notice a change when they next check out their feed. The company, which was bought by Facebook last year, is going to start showing ads to its 150 million users. It's facing what is by now a standard problem for social networks, making money without alienating its hard-earned user base. But Instagram could be a perfect example of making that transition easy, as Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports.
It's a familiar story. You discover a cool new app on your smartphone. You introduce it to all your friends. And then, one day, without warning, you see it. An ad. Consumer behavior consultant Jen Drexler says it's a tricky transition for companies.
You've made people fall in love with you, but now you've changed the terms.
Tech site Mashable found 43% of Instagram users are disappointed about the ads. 17% are furious. William Ward is a professor of social media at Syracuse University.
There's always a risk of alienating users, particularly if the ads are not well targeted.
Still, Instagram ads could achieve the holy grail of marketing, ads people like. Ken Wilber is a professor of marketing at UC San Diego. He says high-quality ads could work well on Instagram.
Fashion ads, travel, things that traditionally have used high-quality images, very often those ads are actually kind of fun and interesting to look at.
Like ads in a fashion magazine, often considered part of the content by readers. But those ads had better be Vogue quality, says consultant Jen Drexler.
So if we're looking at a liquor company who takes pictures of their cocktails each night, that picture better be beautiful. It better be something people want to share and not disruptive to the experience.
Instagram's edge is that its owner, Facebook, has loads of data on all of us. Our likes, our locations, our cocktails of choice. In Manhattan, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
There are some big deadlines looming down in Washington, D.C. The new Joint Congressional Budget Committee that Heidi Moore was talking about up in the wrap is supposed to come up with a mutually acceptable spending plan by mid-December. Another round of automatic spending cuts happens on the 15th of January. And it's not just lawmakers who are under the gun. The legislative calendar matters to interest groups as well, which means it's a busy season for lobbyists in the nation's capital. Marketplace's David Gura takes us on a tour of how influence is used in Washington.
We begin in the halls of Congress, in the Hart Senate Office Building. A new Budget Conference Committee's recommendations are due on December 13th. Ahead of that deadline, lobbyists are pounding the pavement, or in this case, the marble.
The shoe manufacturers of America are going to have a great upsurge in their sales.
That's Richard Fiesta, a lobbyist for the Alliance for Retired Americans, a group that's against changes to Social Security and Medicare.
I think anyone who's concerned about issues or does lobbying is going to be in House and Senate offices very frequently and constantly over the next few weeks.
It's a short walk across Capitol Hill to the Cannon House office building. Christina Martin Fervita lobbies for AARP, one of the most powerful interest groups in Washington. This year so far, AARP has spent more than $4.5 million on lobbying. It's launched a seven-figure ad campaign that'll run in 19 states. Fervita tells me politics is a competitive game.
You know, time is the scarcest resource in Washington. It's always a competition for people's time and their attention.
But she's with a group most lawmakers can't afford to ignore.
We represent 37 million Americans. We definitely have an advantage when we call up and we say, we'd like 15 minutes of your time. We can usually get that.
Capitol Hill isn't the only place where you can connect with lawmakers and staff. We're at the Washington Convention Center, where the Association of the United States Army is having its annual meeting.
The mobility of threat launchers makes them hard to locate. And
this is just a massive floor of exhibits of a variety of businesses that support our armed forces.
That's retired General Guy Swan, one of the group's vice presidents. The convention center is filled with booths. There are tanks and helicopters. But Swan says the mood is different than it was a few years ago. Everyone is on edge.
Whether it's continuing resolutions, the effects of sequestration, the debt ceiling, all of that is kind of the undercurrent here at the conference this week.
This year, the group has spent about $200,000 on direct lobbying. This conference is another way for Swan's organization and for defense contractors in the military to tell politicians and policymakers that they're worried. On the schedule is a congressional staffer's breakfast with the Secretary of the Army and the Army's Chief of Staff.
About 650 people attend that, of which about 200 plus are congressional staff.
Afterward, they're led around the convention center to meet with companies and active duty military. Our tour ends on K Street. Well, in an office on K Street. It's a famous artery in downtown D.C. that's clogged with lawyers and lobbyists. This is the Council on Competitiveness. It's a coalition of CEOs, university presidents, and labor leaders. Council CEO Deborah Wintz-Smith tells me it's a 501c3, a nonprofit.
So by definition, you know, we don't lobby, but we do educate.
Some say that's a distinction without a difference. Wintz-Smith meets with politicians. She testifies on the Hill. The council is also worried about sequestration and about fiscal issues, the debt, the deficit. Wintz-Smith will talk to politicians about these issues next week at the group's annual National Competitiveness Forum.
We have a number of members from Congress that will be coming both to our dinner in the forum and then senior administration officials as well.
It's all part of the expensive education politicians will get ahead of these two big deadlines. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
Coming up.
10 years ago, that whole front street right there was all plywood up, every building. Half of them down on the other side was all plywood up. today, every shop down there, somebody's in.
Eastport, Maine, coming up on our series, American Futures. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials added 61 points today, about a 3%, finished at 15,570. The NASDAQ added 14 points, also a 3%, 3943. The S&P 500 gained 7 points, 0.4%, finished at 1759. For the week that was, the Dow up 1.1%, the NASDAQ bumped up 0.7%, the S&P 500 added 0.9%. Two Seattle tech giants zoomed up following surprisingly good quarterly results after the bell yesterday. Amazon hauled in 9%. Microsoft added 6% today. UPS drove up 1.2%. The delivery service said online shopping should be strong this holiday season. Bond prices held steady. The yield on the 10-year T-note stayed at 2.51%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Monday. The Federal Reserve issues its monthly industrial production report. It was delayed by the shutdown. The National Association of Realtors releases its pending home sales index for September. And on October 28, 1886, the Statue of Liberty was dedicated by President Grover Cleveland. Celebrations were to include fireworks and illumination of Miss Liberty, but they were postponed due to inclement weather. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Next February, there's going to be a new guy running the National Basketball Association. Adam Silver will take over for David Stern as the commissioner of the NBA. And when that happens, the NBA is going to get a whole bunch of brand new basketballs because the ones they're using now have David Stern's signature on them. New commissioner, new signature, new balls. Sounds easy, right? Marketplace's Noel King has the business of balls.
The balls that the NBA uses are made by Spalding, and they're leather. So just like a baseball glove or leather boots, you have to break them in to soften them up. Paul Sullivan is Senior Vice President at Spalding.
There's only really one way to break in a leather basketball, and that is by playing with it.
Breaking in a ball is so crucial that Spalding has a bounce machine to get the process started.
It's a box that is obviously motorized and just keeps feeding the basketball through. And what that does is it wakes up the basketball.
50 bounces in the bounce machine, and the ball is sent off to the teams. Then the players practice with the balls for about 2 months to soften them up even further before they're game ready. Every year, Spalding sends each team 72 brand new balls at the start of the season, times 30 teams, and that's 2,160 balls every year. The new balls, the ones with Adam Silver's signature, won't be used until he takes over as commissioner in February, halfway through the season. So each team will only get 36 of them. Spalding gives all the balls to the NBA, but it's worth it. Victor Matheson teaches sports economics at the College of the Holy Cross.
The reason why you would want that NBA ball contract is not to sell balls to the NBA, but to sell balls to everyone else who wants to be like the NBA.
Everyone else who wants to be like the NBA can buy an official game basketball for around $140. I'm Noel King for Marketplace.
I got an email from Jim Fallows the other day, his idea for the next installment of our series, American Futures. I've got the perfect place, he wrote, but you're going to have to travel a ways to get there.
Where we're going, we don't need roads.
Cirrus 435 Sierra Romeo, we've got Tango for landing.
Destination is at Eastport Echo, Papa Mike for 50.
Jim, the national correspondent for The Atlantic, and his wife Deb are flying around the country in their own plane. Four seats, one engine, a Cirrus SR22 for the aviation-minded among you. They're stopping where they like, with us riding along every now and then, building a picture of what the American economy looks like. For us, today, the American economy looks a lot like this. A warehouse up on a hill overlooking a pier so big it could be an airport runway. A warehouse that's filled with dried wood pulp on its way from the woods of Maine to China.
Can we duck into the warehouse just to get a sense of how much pulp this is?
Yes.
Oh, man! This is unbelievable.
The scale and speed of this is incredible.
Yeah. This is what? Is this a football field, you think, probably?
At least 400 feet.
400 feet.
It's more than a football field.
Yeah.
And it's a football field wide, and it's stacked how high?
Each one of them is about 5 feet.
Five, 10 feet. 20 feet high, football field by a football field. I'm going to have to do the math later.
Yeah. But they usually load anywhere from 12 to 15 of them on a truck, and they take them down there, and the crane just picks the whole lift up.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that we got to see.
Could be a warehouse in any huge port city about to load cargo onto a ship waiting right outside and send it off to Europe or to Asia. But we are in Eastport, Maine, population 1,331. A New England fishing village that's just about as far east as you can get in this country, or as Chris Gardner prefers to say.
We are standing at the deepest natural seaport in the continental United States of America.
Chris Gardner, shaved head, goatee, a body type usually referred to as fire plug, also a relentless advocate for this town and for the port that he's been in charge of the past 5 years. As he stands overlooking that enormous pier, he believes fundamentally that they can do anything here, because that deep a port so far east means he can get bigger ships across the ocean faster, no matter what the cargo is. I'm going to let him tell the story.
Well, in 2010, I was sitting in my office, and my then general manager here at the port, Skip Rogers, called me and said, "We just had a gentleman call, and he wants to ship cows out of Eastport." I said, "Okay, alive or dead?" And he chuckled, and I said, "Don't act like that's not a serious question." What? He says, "Oh, they're alive." I said, "Okay, that's step one." I said, "How are we going to ship them?" "They want to stuff them in boxes." Of course they do. They want to stuff live cows in boxes. And he said, "And oh, by the way, they're pregnant." I said, "Of course they're pregnant. Of course they're pregnant." So they want to ship live, pregnant dairy cattle in boxes out of Eastport, Maine. He said, "That's exactly the phone call that I just got." I said, "Okay." And he said, "What do you want me to tell him?" I said, "Tell him yes." And there was a pause. He said, "What do you mean, yes?" He said, how can we say yes with this permits, this issues? I mean, cows and boxes. How do we?" I said, "Skip, you never lead with no. That crazy phone call that you just got, somebody else is going to get. That's going to be just as crazy to them as it is to us. But you call them back and tell them, not only can we want to." And as a result, we have parlayed that into almost 40,000 head of cattle exported here since 2010.
You never lead with no, Chris says. So in this tiny little town, a place where the economy's been lousy the past decade or so, there are now huge cargo ships with pregnant cows being shipped out to Turkey and wood pulp going to China. Eastport is so small that the lobster docks are just a 10-minute walk or so from the cargo pier, and late in the afternoon, boats are tied up there by the dozen.
Are you guys going out or coming in or standing around? What you doing?
Waiting for fuel.
Waiting for fuel. All right, come on. We're going to come down and say hi. First of all, do me a favor and introduce yourself. Tell me your name.
Jesse McPhail.
How old are you, Jesse?
33.
You've been doing this your whole life?
For a while. First part of my years, I didn't really want to work with my father, so I tried a bunch of other stuff.
So how come you went into lobstering then, finally?
Smartened up.
Tell me about that. You make a pretty good living?
Yep.
Give me a sense. Give me a dollar number.
Oh, I can't tell you that. You the IRS?
Are you comfortable?
I'm pretty comfortable.
How important is it to you that that Eastport sort of grows as a town, right? I mean, one of the things we're talking about here is that this town used to be down on its luck, right? And a bunch of people got together and said, in essence, we're not going to let that happen. Is that important to you?
Yeah, it's kind of good.
Local. Years ago, it was all plywood.
Hang on a minute. Tell me your name.
Basil Pottle.
How old are you, Basil?
65.
Tell me about 10 years ago.
10 years ago, that whole front street right there was all plywood up. Every building. Half of them down on the other side was all plywood up. Today, every shop down there, somebody's in.
So what happened?
Oh, people coming around and seeing that I think that could happen here. Like, I own a campground, and I probably have anywhere between 300 to 400 people in the campground every day that come in this town and go shopping. 10 years ago, there was nothing for them here to do. There wasn't even a restaurant here that sold lobster. So I had to start a restaurant so that they could eat a lobster.
That's so you fish, you have a restaurant, you run a campground. Seems like everybody here has like six jobs.
Yep, you got to have a job for every season.
One of the jobs a lot of these lobstermen have, no matter the season, is handling the cargo down at the pier. They get health insurance there and benefits, too. The trip from the warehouse down to the ship and the pier is short and steep. Five bales go on a truck, and once every 90 seconds, 30 tons of paper gets lifted high off the ground and swung out into the hold. And up on the cargo deck, the Filipino navigator of this Norwegian flagship, it's taking chopped up American trees to China so that they can make paper and sell it back to us, watches with me.
Now what are you going to do? Because there's not enough space for a whole other thing. So what are you going to do?
They're going to put one more.
You think it's going to fit?
Yeah.
I don't think it's going to fit.
One more.
All right, we're going to watch. Oh, no, it's going to fit.
Oh. You see?
He was right, of course. We spent all day up in Eastport running around with people who make their living on or near the water. People on the big cargo ships, people running little lobster boats, people who have three or four or five other jobs just to help them get by. And that, it turns out, is what this slice of the American economy looks like right now. Our series with Jim and Deb Fallows and The Atlantic is called American Futures. We've got maps, a link to Jim's blog, and today a quiz about the Eastport economy. Everything lives online at marketplace.org. And while you're there, drop us a line. Tell us where you think we ought to go next.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out, which can be filed one of two ways, either this week's sign the apocalypse is upon us, or to judge by their spending habits, American consumers are feeling just fine. Thank you very much. Here goes. From Bloomberg News, this item. According to the National Retail Federation, Americans are going to spend $7 billion this year on Halloween costumes for our pets. Woof. All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM. Our series, American Futures, was produced by Bridget Bonner. It was engineered for us by Brendan Willard. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace was developed by JJ Yore. It is produced by Sitar Nieves. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer around here. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you Monday, everybody. And this is APM.